Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in Philadelphia, was an amateur boxer, a nightclub singer, and a pianist. He became a writer and has been voted the number one sports columnist in the nation 13 times by the Associated Press. He was a panelist on ESPN's Sports Reporters for 26 years and is the author of 10 books, including Tuesdays with Maury and his latest book, Finding Chica, which was just released on November 5th. He's written 3 plays and hosts a nationally syndicated radio show here, right here on WJR. His name, Mitch Albom. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasul. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to our own Mitch Albom. Mitch, welcome back. It's a real honor to have you once again.
Well, you're a gift, Jack, and I'm pleased and honored to be on your program.
Thank you. Thank you. Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad?
Well, I was a middle child. I was raised in South Jersey, just outside of Philadelphia. I was blessed with a mother and a father who didn't come from much. They were children of immigrants, but they believed in family. That was very important. And we ate all of our meals together. No matter when my dad came home, we waited for him. No matter when my brother or sister came home, we waited. And we made sure that every night we were together with no interruptions, no television or radio or anything like that. And that's where not only my love of family was formed, but my love for storytelling was formed, because all the stories got told around the kitchen table. And when our older relatives would come, and grandparents and uncles and aunts, we had a big family, I would hear all of them. So I came from a tight-knit family. Unfortunately, they're gone, my parents now, but I consider my life and my work to be a reflection of the values that they put in me, and particularly the storytelling that I grew up with.
Where did you get your love for sports?
You know, it may sound weird, but I don't have that great a love for sports. I have a love for telling stories and writing. And sports is a great stage for that. You know, you have a winner and a loser. You have the last chance, the last game, the drama of a winner take all. And so it's a great backdrop with which to write. And I came out of journalism school without any intent of going into sports writing. I just wanted to write things that touched people. And it just so happened there was an opening at a sports magazine that led to an opening at a newspaper, which I wanted a different job, but they ended up seeing that I had written for a sports magazine, so they stuck me in the sports job. And sports has just been like a gravitational thing that just kept pulling me back until I finally said, you know what? Actually, I can tell my stories in sports. It's fine. You know, there's some really good ones. And so I've been in that ever since. But it shouldn't be a surprise that I ended up branching out as soon as the opportunities came, because I'm not a lifer in the sports world.
We're talking to our own Mitch Albom. Mitch, why are people so moved and inspired by stories?
Well, that's a good question. And I think it goes back to the dawn of time. I think as soon as we could communicate, if you look on the drawings on the cave walls that they find, they were stories. And the Bible is told through stories. You know, there's a reason that the Bible is not a textbook, you know, with the question one, question two, question three, question. It's all stories, right? And fables and parables, they're all stories that bring home a point. And we've been telling stories to one another since man could talk. So I think, and even now with the internet and all that, still streaming services, what are all they do? They're just creating more stories, you know. Even YouTube, they tell little stories. And so I'm in a time-honored business. It may actually be the oldest profession, even older than what they usually say is the oldest profession.
I think speaking of oldest, I think the longest-running TV show is 60 Minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Don Hewitt was the founder producer. One time they asked him, what does 60 Minutes do? He said, four words. Tell me a story.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully you don't want to be one of their stories. What do all great storytellers have in common?
The ability to engage someone out of their world and into the storyteller's world. That's what all good storytellers have.
This is the third time you've been on the show.
Wow. I'm honored.
The first time we were talking about storytelling and you said, Jack, the greatest storyteller ever was a Jewish carpenter who lived 2,000 years ago. And he only told stories for 3 years. And here, 2,000 years later, a couple billion people claim to be buying the stories he was selling. So, okay, 1985. Let's go to 1985.
Uh-huh.
You come to Detroit. You get a job with the Free Press. How did that come about?
Mike Downey was a young columnist who worked here, was very popular, and he left to go to Los Angeles. And the Free Press wanted to replace him with another young columnist. That was really the only reason I got a shot. I was working in Florida. I was very young, younger than Downey, and had just been doing it for about a year. But I had won some award that put me kind of in a national, jet stream, I guess. And they called me up and said, would you like to come up for an interview? And then the next couple of hours, I got a call from the Detroit News, which was a rival, really strong rival of the Free Press at that time. And they said, would you like to come up for an interview? And I said, well, I just got a call from the Free Press. And they said, well, that's all right. You know, we'll interview you separately. And they were so competitive back then that the News wanted to put on a young writer that would maybe steal away the readers from the Free Press who had liked Mike Downey and now were looking for somebody. And the Free Press wanted to replace Mike Downey. So I ended up flying up here and I had to do things very, because I believe in being fair and equitable and straightforward. And so I flew up on the Free Press's dime, did my interview with them, stayed at the hotel downtown. The next morning, I checked out of the hotel, then turned around and checked back into the hotel on the Detroit News's dime, did the interview with them and flew home on their ticket. And a few days later, I was offered both jobs within like an hour of one another at the exact same money for the News and the Free Press, which I still to this day don't know how that happened without some collusion. But I chose to go to the Free Press, nothing against the News. I just thought a morning paper and the style that it was written. I thought that they celebrated writing a little bit more. And I'm very happy that I made that choice.
We're talking about your album, and I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and we're with our own Mitch Albom, who's the author of 10 books and 3 plays, and he was a panelist on ESPN The Sports Reporters for 26 years. Mitch, in 96, you joined us at JR. Mm. How did that come about?
J.P. McCarthy had contacted me several times while I was working over in an FM station doing sports in the mornings. When I would come down here and do his show or Focus, he would say, what are you doing over at that FM station? You should be down here at WJR. I would say, well, you know, you guys are legendary and you don't have room for somebody like me anyhow. And I was just doing a couple minutes in the mornings on WLLZ. And then something, I can't remember who or whatever left or happened, but the afternoon thing happened and J.P. McCarthy called me up and said, come down here and talk to them. You can be in the afternoons if you know if they want you, and I could be in the mornings and you could be in the afternoons. We'd be this great team. And that was in 1995, I believe. And I came down and I interviewed and I said, well, you know, to be honest with you, I'm not interested in doing sports talk for a couple of hours a day. I never particularly was fond of sports talk radio. No knock against it. I just, for me, you know, being in the business, to have to hear people call up and make trade suggestions or things like that, I just thought, I can't do that every day. And that, to my delight and surprise, they said, well, we don't want you to do sports. We want you to do a general show. And that intrigued me. And I said, okay, well, now we're talking. Because as I said to you earlier in our conversation, I wasn't born and bred into sports. My interests were always beyond the sports world. And so I agreed to do it. And sadly, J.P. McCarthy passed away right around that time. And so we never really got to work together as he had planned. But he was the one who was instrumental in me coming here. And Mike Feasey ended up becoming the GM here, and helped shepherd me in, and was a champion of mine for many years.
We have that thing in common, and Mike Feasey was a fantastic human being.
Yes, he was, and gone way too soon.
Talk to us, how did you prep for your two-hour show back in 96?
Well, we didn't know what we were doing. Our goal was to create like a Cheers bar atmosphere. And so we had myself and Ken Brown and Rachel Nevada and, I can't even remember, Jim McFarland and Lisa Goich. And we had like 6, 7, 8, 9 people who were in the roster. And we had so many people that we didn't even have enough microphones. And so one day, Monday, someone would come in, and Tuesday, other people would come in, and Wednesday, different people would come in, and we shifted around. The whole idea was just to create fun. And my thinking was that at the end of the day, you don't want to hear the same thing that you heard when you drove in the morning. At the end of the day, you want a place to go to, you know, like the Cheers bar, you know, some place where everybody knows your name. So you want it friendly and funny and light. And that was strange to WJR, because WJR was very buttoned down back then, and it's not exactly open collar right now, but it's a little looser. But back then, it was very traditional radio. And all of a sudden, we came in with music and bands and musical outs and games and things like that, and they didn't know what to do with us. We sat down in the far end of the offices, and you know, we used to make noise and laugh, and you know, everything else was kind of quiet and very professional, and I felt like we were like the Animal House fraternity of WJR at the far end of the hall. But now I've been on, I think, longer than anybody here, and so in some ways we became the tradition, and we love doing the show. And even today, it's still kind of nutty, but I'd like to think we inform people as well as have fun and give some insight, and it's enjoyable.
How do you prep today?
Well, before we used to have a lot of stories and guests. We had a lot of guests, lots of guests. And now we've come to realize that people don't really listen necessarily for guests. They listen for the hosts. And if you got somebody interesting, great. But that's not the reason, because guests they can get anywhere else. So a lot of times we'll just kind of talk one or two in the afternoon. We'll call one another or text one another, really, email and say, you know, what did you see in the news? You want to do this today? Maybe we should get this guy. Maybe we should get this issue. But more often than not, I end up coming in and whatever was kind of on my mind when I was driving in becomes the first thing we talk about. And sometimes that'll end up going for 45 minutes. You know, like, why is it that, you know, when it rains outside, nobody can drive, you know? Or why is it that everybody's so nice at Christmas time, and come January 10th, everybody's back to being surly with one another. Why is it? And we'll talk about things like that. So, I don't know, Jackie. You know, there's not a lot of formula to it. It's different every day.
1997, you write Tuesdays with Maury, the best-selling memoir of all time. Who's Maury?
Maury was Maury Schwartz, my college professor at Brandeis University, who I was really enamored with. I took every class he offered. I majored in sociology on account of him. He became more like an uncle than a teacher. And I always promised I would stay in touch with him when I graduated. And then I broke that promise every day, week, month, and year for 16 years while I was so busy doing all these things that you are very impressed with here. And of course, the price you pay for that kind of ambition is that you don't have time for the people in your life. And I didn't make time for him, and suddenly discovered him one night on television talking to Ted Koppel about what it was like to die from Lou Gehrig's disease. And that's how I found out that he had Lou Gehrig's disease. And I went to go visit him out of guilt, what I thought would be a one-time visit. And I was so impressed with how he was living his final days and how precious he held every moment, and how together he was with his life, and how content he was with his dying, that I realized he had something that I did not. And if I didn't change my ways, I never would. And so I began to go visit him again and again and again and again and again. And it turned out every Tuesday that he had left for his life. And during those Tuesdays, I wrote down the things that he shared with me. And those became Tuesdays with Maury, which became a little book that was supposed to just pay his medical bills. It wasn't supposed to be a big book. And that changed my life.
20 million plus copies later, it's changed the world. All right, speaking of changing the world, January 12th, 2010, the earthquake in Haiti. Tell us about it.
Well, like everybody, I just saw it on TV. I'd never been to Haiti, didn't know anything about Haiti. About a week or so later, a pastor from the Detroit area came down and said that an orphanage that he was associated with, he thought might have been destroyed down in Port-au-Prince, and they couldn't get word out, and could we help them in any way? And he came on the radio show. And I was so moved by that, I just thought, oh my gosh, you've got an orphanage of kids and you don't know if they're alive or dead because you couldn't get phone calls in. So I tried to arrange for a trip to go down there, and we had a lot of fits and starts, but in the end, we got a small plane. And about 3 weeks after the earthquake, I flew down there with him and a couple of other people and witnessed firsthand this terrible 7.0 magnitude earthquake that killed in 45 seconds 3% of Haiti's population, which was about 300,000 people dead, and left 10% of their population, or close to a million people, homeless. And many of those homeless who had survived were all over Port-au-Prince because that's the only big city. And they were in this orphanage that hadn't been destroyed but was overrun. And I began to go back to that orphanage to try to rebuild it with guys from Detroit. And within a matter of months had taken over the operation of that orphanage, which I run to this day. And I have been in Haiti come January every single month for 10 years.
120 times.
120 visits, that's right.
120 weekends.
Yeah. Well, they're not only weekends. They're sometimes long, a whole long week.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tell us about the Haitian people.
The Haitian people are the second poorest in the entire world, the poorest on the Western Hemisphere. The average salary is about $2 a day. They get by without power every night that goes off at night, without water in many cases, without electricity. Many of them live in tents or hardscrabble shelters. The poverty level is close to 65-70%. The illiteracy rate is also up around 60%. You have to pay to go to school, to go to public school. So you have people who start, stop. Whenever there's money, you have kids who are 24, 25 years old and are in seventh grade because they haven't been able to go on any regular basis. It's hot. It's uncomfortable. Extraordinarily difficult to find food, fuel, water, and yet, in light of all of that, the Haitian people are some of the most joyous and life-celebrating people that I have ever met anywhere on the planet, and I've been around this planet. And there is a spirit and a strength and an optimism that maybe one day tomorrow will be better. That exists there that is hard to justify given how tough they've had it. And the children of Haiti are remarkable. And I challenge anyone to go and meet the children of Haiti, particularly those in our orphanage, and not fall in love and not say, what can I do to help these children? And it just so happens that I did that 10 years ago, and I've been doing it ever since.
We're talking to Mitch Albom. When we come back, we're going to ask him about the orphanage. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula, and we're with Mitch Albom, who for the last 10 years has gone down to Haiti 4 to 5 days every month. That's 120 months. And you've run Have Faith Haiti Mission Orphanage, which today houses 52 children.
We are an orphanage in Port-au-Prince, about a quarter acre, half acre lot. with, well, we've had 52 children come through. Not all of them are there now because some are in college here in America. We take them from the poorest families, and we give them all the things that they don't have out in Haitian life. Food, shelter, a bed, their own bed, schooling, clothing, medical care, nutrition, and love, endless love from 14 nannies, 15 teachers, three separate directors, a support staff of 9 or 10 people. So there's a good 40 people there who I employ for the purpose of loving these children who in many cases have been abandoned, left behind. One was left to die out in the woods when he was just a couple weeks old, and somebody found him and brought him to the police. A woman picked him up, brought him to the police, and the police said, what'd you pick him up for? You should have just let him die. Now we have to do paperwork. We have a child who was left at a malnutrition clinic. No one ever came back for him, left there for a year, then went to a tuberculosis clinic and was left there for a year, and then was left at another clinic, and no one ever came back for him. 2, 3 years old, 4 years old, children under the most dire circumstances, children whose homes were flooded away, blown away by earthquakes or hurricanes. These are the children we take in and we raise with the goal of educating them, getting them to 18 with the equivalent of an American education, and then sending them to American universities, all of them. And every single one of them, Jack, will go to college. And we have scholarships lined up for every single one of them. And then once they finish college or grad school, whatever they want to learn, they will go back to Haiti and make their country better and put us out of business one day. That's my hope.
Mitch Albom, what's the single biggest thing those 52 young people have taught you?
That childhood in its purest form is the most precious gift that we have on this earth. And when I say in its purest form, no cell phones, no computers, no television sets, no outside influences telling them what's cool or what isn't. These are the children that I get to see because we don't have any of those things. Consequently, you'll have a 10 or 11-year-old boy who, when you go down there, he'll take your arm, Jack, and put it around him because nobody taught him that at 10 or 11, he's too old to have a man put his arm around him. That kind of pure childhood and pure joy is an absolute gift that they have given us. You know, people always say what we've given them. No, they're a gift, and every child that I've had a chance to come in contact with is a gift, including Chica, who I wrote the new book about.
All right, let's talk about Chica Jean. She was born January 9th, 2010, 3 days before the earthquake, and her mom in 2012 died while giving birth to a baby boy, and then Chica's dropped off at the orphanage in the spring of 2013. Tell us what she was like back then.
Well, as you point out, she survived the earthquake, sleeping on her mother's chest when she was 3 days old, and the house collapsed around them, and she survived. So she slept that night out in the dirt in the sugarcane fields, and she slept for many weeks after that there. So she was born tough. And by the time she came to us, she was the toughest three-year-old I've ever seen. She bossed around all the other kids, even though she was the youngest one there. She told them when they can go to the bathroom and when they can walk and when they can play. And you know, she was rough and tumble. And I remember when she came in for her interview, and her godmother was holding her. And most kids, they don't even make eye contact with you. You know, they just look down at the floor because, you know, I'm a strange-looking guy to them. They're in a strange place. But she sat there, and she looked right at me, and she crossed her arms at one point, like, are we done? You know, and so I was looking at her and kind of making faces. At her one point, I stuck my tongue out. And then she stuck her tongue out at me. And then I laughed, and then she laughed at me. And I said, boy, this little girl is brave. And as it would turn out, she would need to be brave. I just didn't know how much she would need it.
As Mitch just mentioned, just this past week, his 10th and latest book, Finding Chica, A Little Girl, An Earthquake, and the Making of a Family. All right, May of 2015, let's go back. What happened?
I get a call from our director in Haiti on site, and he says, there's something the matter with Chica. What? Her face is drooping. Her eye, her mouth is drooping. Well, did you take her to the doctor? Yes. What did the doctor do? He gave her eye drops. I said, I don't think this is eye drops, Alan. This is something neurological. I thought maybe it was Bell's palsy or something like that. I said, we have to get an MRI. There's only one MRI machine in Haiti. You have to bring $750 cash with you and wait online to get a picture taken. When the picture was taken and it came back, there was a two-sentence summation. It said, the child has something on her brain. Whatever it is, there's no one in Haiti who can help her. That was it. So I brought her to America very quickly, scrambled together a visa for her and a passport and all that. And my hope was to bring her to U of M, where I know a brain surgeon there, and have them look at her. And hopefully they would say, well, this is, you know, non-malignant, something that we can get rid of. And then she could go back to being a kid. And we brought her here, and they did brain surgery on her within a few weeks, hopeful that they could take this thing out. And when they got in, they found out it was much more complicated than they thought. And so when we came in for the prognosis, they told us we were hoping that it would be a stage one, maybe stage two tumor. That would be the worst. And when I got in with the doctor, with my wife, he said, well, I have some bad news. She has something called DIPG. And I said, is that stage one or stage two? And he said, stage four. And basically, she had a malignant, aggressive, non-operable brain tumor that was going to take her in 4 months, according to the doctor, that she would be dead in 4 months. And he said, I would take her back to Haiti and just let her play out her last days until she can't function anymore, and then she'll pass away. But because I knew what kind of kid she was, because I knew how she was born, and I knew how tough she was, I said, no, she's a fighter, and if she fights, we fight. And that began what turned out to be a two-year battle that she put up against this thing that was supposed to take her in 4 months. And during that time, we traveled around the world searching for a cure. And we became, Jack, most blessedly, a family. And this was a tremendous gift that little Chica gave my wife and I, because we didn't have any kids of our own, even though we have all these orphans that we help raise. And that experience is what I wrote in the book, Finding Chica.
We're talking to Mitch Albom, whose latest book, Finding Chica, A Little Girl, An Earthquake, and the Making of a Family. You can buy them any bookstores, Amazon, anywhere in the world. And I'm Jack Rasulla, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasulla. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Mitch Albom about his latest book, Finding Chica, A Little Girl, An Earthquake, and the Making of a Family. You and Janine had been married for 20-plus years.
Mm-hmm.
You never had children.
Right.
You're both in your late 50s.
Right.
Mitch, for decades, you've had a habit of, from 9 till noon, 6 days a week, you write. And now God gives you this special little girl. How did it change your life?
Well, first of all, the 9 to noon stuff was out the door, and so was everything else, because she wasn't just a special little girl. She was a sick little girl, although she didn't behave like a sick little girl. But we had to take her to treatments for brain surgery and then experimental surgery and experimental brain surgery in New York. She was on steroids, which made her extremely large and gave her an appetite of two truckers. And then we ended up taking her to Germany for immunology treatment. So our way of life had to change. Our timing had to change. The way we spent our time changed. And that was fine. Chica opened up a whole new world for us as human beings as well as parents.
I quote Janine now. We were parents and grandparents' bodies.
Yeah.
It's never too late to open your heart to love children and to love each other.
Yeah.
What are some of the biggest special experiences you had with Chica?
Well, there were a lot of them, Jack, you know, and they were revelatory. I mean, the fun ones, like when we would sing, In fact, I have a little clip here of us singing Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. And whenever we would sing together, she would invariably put her hand over my mouth and tell me to stop singing so she could sing by herself. And you'll hear here, we're singing together, and all of a sudden she puts her hand over my mouth so that she corrects me on it. Listen.
Twinkle, little star, how I wonder what you are. No.
What you are?
Yeah.
Sure.
See, twinkle, twinkle, little star. Oh, I wonder what you are.
So there was moments like that, and there were many moments where Chica said things that just stunned us. For example, she was lying in bed one night, and we were kissing her goodnight, and she said, how did you find me? And I said, what do you mean? And she said, how did you find me? I said, do you mean how did you come to us? And she said, yeah, how did you find me? And I realized, you know, for an orphan, that kind of a question is kind of understandable, because for them, especially as a three-year-old girl, she couldn't really remember her mother or anything that came before it. She felt like she was sort of lost, and we found her and brought her into the orphanage. And we had to explain to her that she had a mother and her mother loved her, and you know, that we were not her mommy and daddy, and we never had her call us mommy and daddy, and we always told her about the world before her. I remember a time also where she couldn't walk anymore, and this was probably the biggest thing that I remember lesson-wise, that she couldn't walk, and I had to carry her everywhere. You know, I'd carry her to the bathroom, carry her to the bed, carry her to the car. And we were coloring at a table, and I realized I was late for the radio show. And I got up. I said, Chica, I got to go. And she said, no, stay in color. I said, Chica, I have to work. And she said, Mr. Mitch, I have to play. I said, well, okay, I know you have to play, but this is my job. And she said, no, it's not. Your job is carrying me. And, you know, after I laughed, I realized, well, of course, she's right. You know, my job was carrying her. All of our jobs are carrying our children and carrying the neediest children wherever we go. And it was a very honorable job, and one that I wish I still had. And so, you know, out of the mouths of babes, as they say, Chica had a lot of wisdom.
I quote you now. I realized families are like pieces of art. They can be made from many materials. Sometimes they are from birth. Sometimes they are melded. Sometimes they are forcibly constructed. And sometimes they are merely the confluence of time and circumstances, mixing together like eggs being scrambled in a Michigan kitchen.
Yes, which Chica and I used to do every morning, and we would make eggs together, and that was one of her favorite things, and she would help crack the egg and stir it and put the butter in. And, you know, as she got sicker, Jack, she became really, I think, there was something else going on with her. And one night we heard her singing from our bedroom, and Janine went in with a little camera to film her. And usually when you go in with a camera and a kid, they stop singing because, you know, they're embarrassed. But she didn't stop. In fact, she sang for 8 minutes straight a song called Child of God. I'm no longer a slave to fear. I am a child of God. And she was singing this, and Janine was inches away from her filming her, and she didn't even look at her. And I swear she was in some kind of communication with God at that moment. And here's a little clip of her singing that song.
I'm no longer a slave to fear. I am a child of God.
And it was after we heard that that we realized that, you know, at least I realized that maybe we're not going to have Chica forever. And, you know, maybe we had to prepare ourselves for the day that she was gone. And that day eventually came, April 7th of 2017. I'll never forget that day. But even in that, the day before she passed, there were hospice nurses there, and her heart rate slowed down, and they said, well, this is the end, you know, this is kind of it. And we got in bed with her, and we were holding her, and I heard a sound coming from her chest, and I said, wait, it sounds like she's struggling. And the hospice people said, no, those are just the sounds that children make at the end. And I said, no, I can tell she's fighting. She's a fighter, and we're going to fight. And we lifted her up and began pounding on her back. with the little rubber couplers that they give you. And I said, come on, Chica, you can. And within 5 minutes, she was back to a normal heart rate and breathing rate. And she lived another day. And that day was the day that everybody came to say goodbye to her and to wish her, you know, her voyage and everything. She gave us that one more 24 hours, that last gift from Chica. And the last line of the book is that I say, you know, we didn't lose a child, we were given one. And that's how I feel. She was a gift, and all children, even if you lose them after a short period of time, are gifts in our lives.
Speaking of gifts, Janine's been a gift.
Mm.
How
to everybody.
Did your love for Janine grow in those 2 years, Mitch Albom?
Exponentially. You know, I think men are sometimes selfish. I know I was. And when you're younger, you think, well, you know, I got a wife and we have children now that I'm going to have to share her. She's going to be busy with the kids. And, you know, and I think I was like that when I was younger. And we got married kind of late. And so chances of having kids weren't very good anyhow. And we ended up never having them, something I truly regret. And now, or when Chica came into our lives, I saw how not only do you not lose your wife, you gain a whole different person because you get to see your wife as a mother and as someone who cares for a child. And it brings out this whole other element of her that you can love. It's like a shadow of the woman. In addition to the woman who you loved as just a man and a woman being married, now there's this other amazing person to love who you say, look at her with that child and look at the love that she shares with that child. And look at the way Chica pulls her hair over her head and says, look, Mr. Mitch, we have the same hair now, you know, and sleeps on her lap when she watches a movie and sings lullabies to her. And so I was very foolish when I was younger to ever think that having children would have taken Janine away from me in some way. It's exactly the opposite. You become this unit and that's what we became. And that's why the book says the making of a family, because Chica made us a family.
You also wrote a book, Mitch, The Five People You Meet in Heaven. Mm. Someday when you go up there and meet our Heavenly Father, she'll be there.
I hope so.
Hugging you. And
I hope she's the first. Yeah, I mean, my parents are there and all of that, but the aching that I have to hold Chica again, it would take heaven to satisfy. And so I hope you're right.
Thank you, Mitch. Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible.
Believe in yourself.